Good morning. It's about 10 minutes after the hour, 10 minutes after 8 o'clock here in the Central Time Zone, and about 10 minutes after 9 o'clock, where Doug Greenwald is in the wilds of Maryland, on the fringes of Washington, D.C. Doug, good morning.
Good morning, guys.
How are things?
Morning, Doug.
Is it a white Christmas out there?
Probably no, it's not. Been a pretty balmy Christmas. In fact, they think it's going to rain today, and we've been, you know, mid to low 50s. So I don't think we're humming white Christmas around here at this moment in time.
But there's all that snow out west, I guess, through Oklahoma and Texas and Kansas, and it's got to be moving in your direction. It's going to miss us, I think. We're going to have a brown Christmas up here in northern Minnesota, which is a stunning development to me.
We'll see what shows up.
Yeah, well, okay. Well, get ready. I think it's on the way. David Adelpunt is with us, and today we talk about Advent. This is our Doug's fourth installment in his Advent series. It's been fascinating, Doug, really learning about the bigger picture, as you say, from 30,000 feet or from 5,000 feet and trying to get our arms around the whole story, which we started with Elizabeth and Zechariah and the birth of John the Baptist and all the meaning in that. Now we progressed along to the road to Bethlehem and Joseph and Mary responding to that call for the census. And where do we go from here?
Well, we need to pick up the shepherds. Mm-hmm. And why don't we just do that in verse 8 here?
I'll tell you what, I am forgetting something here, and I don't want to forget it. Before we get started with the shepherds, we did have a listener who asked me to ask you, you know, if David and probably Mary were both of David's line, and were residents of Judea and Bethlehem specifically, if that was his hometown, why is it that he went to Nazareth?
You know, Luke gives us maybe a dozen contextual clues here in the way he phrases things and the information he gives us, and I would suggest that's one of them. To an observant Jew in the first century, the first thing that would strike them is exactly that point. Why, if the clan of David is all gathered around Bethlehem, is this couple 90 miles to the north in Nazareth? Now, this is a culture where you probably are born and raised and never move more than a mile away from your home from the day you're born till the day you die, except, of course, if you're a shepherd, and making exceptions for major festivals when everyone goes to Jerusalem. So there's two possible explanations for that. And one of them is, and we have to go way back into intertestamental history period here, maybe even starting with 586 BC, when Judea falls, the southern kingdom falls to the Babylonians, and the merchant class and the elite families and all the bright young men are exiled off to Babylon. Then Babylon falls, and Cyrus the Persian takes over, and he allows Ezra and Nehemiah to come back. And they start rebuilding the walls, and they rededicate the temple. And then but most of the exiles did not return. That's the point of that statement. Life is actually pretty good in Babylon, and a lot of them, the exiles, basically are of the mindset, we're never going to return to our homeland until Jews govern Jews again. We're not going to go back when pagans rule our land. Well, in 332 BC, Alexander the Great comes in here under God's plan, brings the Greek language. He dies after 9 years. His generals fight over things. And by about 190 BC, one of the Seleucid follow-ons, the Antiochus Epiphanes IV, becomes king, and he gets a little rambunctious, and he wants to attack Egypt, and he gets thwarted by Rome, and he faults the observant Jews for that issue, and he starts to slaughter thousands of them. And in 167 BC, as he continues his anti-Semitism, he goes into the temple in Jerusalem and slaughters pigs on the great altar there. Well, that is such a defamation. That is so an abomination to the Jews that a revolt starts. And it's the revolt started by Judas the Maccabee. That revolt takes probably 20 years to totally get rid of all the vestiges of Greek control and the Seleucid Empire out of the land. And finally, by about 142 BC, we have Jews governing Jews again. the high priesthood as well as the kingship is consolidated in the Hasmonean family, which is a historical priestly family. And within 20 years after that, people in Babylon are starting to think, maybe we should finally go back home because Jews are now governing Jews. And so there's a whole second wave of exiles that starts to return. And remember, in the 400 years that they've been in Babylon, they've reproduced and grown into quite a large number of people. And so in the 120 BC, 110 BC, these exile waves start coming back in, and you'd think they would set up shop around Jerusalem to be near the Holy Temple, but no, most of them set up shop in the north, in the Galilee district. And why would they do that? Well, like many, many Jews, they have memorized most of their Old Testament scriptures, and they remember Isaiah 9, verses 1 and 2, where it says that the light will first shine, that's the light of Messiah, in the tribal allotments of Zebulun and Naphtali. And when you look at the tribal allotments in New Testament times, Nazareth is in the tribal allotment of Zebulun, and Capernaum is in the allotment of Naphtali. Now, when we read the Mishnah, we also learn something interesting, that there's a clan, presumably an offshoot of the Davidic clan, as far as we can tell, called the Natsur clan. And they're part of these exiles coming back, and they want to establish settlements in the north, almost like the settlement mentality of today, because they want to reclaim this region for Judaism when Messiah comes. A further backdrop here is if you're a Gentile, you don't want to live in the south. That's too hard of a living. Bad soil, not very much rainfall. So all the Gentiles prefer to live in the north. That's where they're concentrated. And so these Jews start to return, and they're going to establish settlements to ultimately take this over for Judaism when Messiah comes. Now, when we read the Mishnah, we find that the Natsur clan split off in three directions. Some of them went to the Golan Heights and established a community there. Some went to the northern Galilee. And a third branch went to southern Galilee, and we think established the town that we now know as Nazareth from the Natsur clan. You can see the phonetic connection, yes, there, and the linguistic connection. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, the people in Nazareth are messianic zealots. They talk about Messiah morning, noon, and night. They're there to reclaim this area for Messiah. And so the annunciation that Messiah is going to come finally was made in a town, a little teeny town, that was full of messianic zealots. Now, freeze that thought. Now, when we go back down to Bethlehem, if we stand there 3 miles to the east, we can see a huge hill where there used to be a monument on top of it called the Herodian. It was something Herod built to himself about 30 years before the birth of Jesus. And part of that backdrop is he conscripted over 1,000 people from the greater Bethlehem area for a multi-year project to move one hill and place all that dirt on top of an adjoining hill to make it twice as tall. That's the image Jesus has in mind when he talks about a faith that moves mountains during the Monday and Tuesday teaching days during Passion Week. And they're all standing on the top of the Mount of Olives looking at this physical object here of a mountain that had been moved by Herod. Upshot here is that Herod is hated by the Bethlehemite people for doing these kinds of things. Joseph is a tradesman. Really not a carpenter. That's a whole other subject, but we won't open it up. But when we get into the linguistic word meaning there, he's much more a tradesman than he is just a carpenter. You can't make it alone by being just a carpenter. You have to be the master of a number of trades. And since most things are built out of stone, he's probably primarily a stonemason, and likewise is Jesus. And so perhaps to get away from the reach of these conscription building programs that Herod the Great does, Joseph might have said, we're going to move out of here and go live in the north. For a second reason, we also believe that's where Messiah is first going to be seen, and so we want to be there when he first arrives. So if you can fuse those two thoughts together, that's the most plausible explanation we can come up with as to why Mary and Joseph will be found in Nazareth, not in Bethlehem.
You know, that that description of Joseph as a tradesman and probably a worker in stone, as then would be Jesus, adds a little extra passion, if you will, to Jesus' comment about tearing down those stones and rebuilding it in 3 days. I mean, I can see him using his hands to tell that story.
Well, it also really underscores Paul's reference to the, to Jesus being the chief cornerstone.
Indeed. Right. Yes. Yes. So we're on our way from Nazareth to Bethlehem. And last week we talked about the Cataluma, the guest room, and how they may have holed up in a cave underneath a small home in Bethlehem for Mary to give birth. And there's shepherds in the fields. Let's start with that now.
Well, when Luke in chapter 2, verse 8 tells us that in the same region, there were some shepherds staying out in the fields and keeping watch over their flocks by night, he's given us some cultural clues here. A first century Bethlehemite person, or anyone really in Judea, would reaction first might be, why are sheep in the fields? Sheep should not be in the fields at night. They should be in sheep pens for protection. And that's true. And if we weren't confined to radio, I would show you some pictures of sheep pens, and we could get a feel as to how sheep were normally kept at night so that they weren't attacked by particularly foxes that roam these hills. And so the first question that gets raised here are, why are they in the fields? Now, there's another clue here with fields. It must be that the wheat harvest is complete, or sheep would never be allowed in the fields at night. It turns out, from a chemical composition point of view, that sheep manure is the ideally balanced fertilizer for regeneration of fields. It's the best chemical fertilizer composition of any manure in nature, basically. And so sheep are certainly welcome in the fields, but only after the harvest is done. And the wheat harvest is done in Bethlehem in mid to late June. So there's another clue on why Jesus is most likely a summer birth. We had our first clue last week. And so this raises some further questions. Why are they in the fields at night? Well, when we read Josephus, the Jewish historian who wrote for Rome as his patron, we find out such things as his estimation that 200,000 paschal lambs were needed for sacrifice in the temple every Passover. Now, that's a lot of baby lambs. So you need quite a number of mom and dad sheep to produce up to 200,000 paschal lambs every year. And if you've ever walked around the Jerusalem area, it's very hilly. There's no flat area of 100 acres here and there where you can keep large flocks. And so Josephus tells us that temple flocks used to create paschal lambs were decentralized all around the greater Jerusalem area, including as far south as Bethlehem. So we have a pretty strong suspicion here that these are temple sheep. Their purpose is to create paschal lambs, and they are so large that they won't fit in any of the traditional sheep folds that village sheep are kept in.
That's astounding. It also paints a picture of the temple slaughtering 200,000 lambs during the Passover week, did you say, or on Passover itself?
During Passover week. And one of the things that we fail to appreciate is the industrial engineering it took to process over 100,000 paschal lambs within probably a 24-hour period of time. And all the blood that was created and all the rinsing systems and water systems that were needed to purge this blood, it was quite an undertaking that I think even industrial engineers of today would marvel over.
It's not a pretty picture, actually. It sounds like slaughtering and getting good cuts out of the sheep were the main activity of the temple.
That's why all the clans of ordinary priests were on duty during that festival time, up to 20,000 of them, because this was an enormous undertaking. And one of the ironies that comes out of this is this blood diluted water ends up flowing through the Kidron Valley, and most likely the night that Jesus left the upper room at midnight and walked across Temple Mount on his way to Gethsemane and had to cross the Kidron Valley, he either jumped over or actually had to wade through pretty pink water from all the blood from those paschal lambs.
That's an astounding image to hold on to for a minute here.
Well, let's get back to these shepherds.
Yeah.
As much as the 23rd Psalm romanticizes shepherds, by the time of the first century, shepherds are scorned. They're derided. they're the lowest on the totem pole of status. The rabbis have decreed that they practice an unclean profession. Some rabbis have decreed that because they move their flocks over lands of other people and eat other people's grass, and they have no capacity for retribution to pay back that grass, that they can never be forgiven. The rabbis have also held that shepherds are so unreliable, so untrustworthy, that they cannot testify in a Jewish court of law. So with that sketch, you get the idea who these shepherds are? They're the outcasts. They're the shameful. They're the people who are on the outside looking in this culture. And all of that just adds to the wonderment and marvel of what happens in this passage. Now, another thing we also wonder about is when we get into birthing season. The major birthing of Paschal lambs is in late March, but there's a second wave of birthing that's mid to late June. And so part of what we wonder about is if another reason these sheep are out in the fields at night is because it's the second wave of birthing, and you do not want to have birthing taking place in the confines of a sheepfold, that these are temple sheep, these are temple shepherd, and there may well have been Paschal lambs being actually born in Bethlehem's fields that evening, the night that the Paschal, perfect Paschal lamb was born.
Somehow that seemed to fit perfectly. That's kind of a God's timing thing.
Yeah, there's a lot of God's timing going on here. From the Roman Empire creating peace all over the known world, from the Roman Empire putting in a road system, which is an infrastructure to communicate the good news rapidly and quickly, and from bringing in the Greek language in this land with Alexander the Great, which is the perfect language for the good news, the gospel. So God is always at work, sometimes at 30,000 feet, sometimes at 5,000 feet, and oftentimes we can't see it, except in the rearview mirror. But there's an awful lot of orchestration going on that has made this night possible.
Another question comes to mind here, especially the idea that these lowly shepherds were really the first to receive the message, but they received it in a spectacular way. I mean, angels in the sky. You'd think that would have been seen all over by everybody. But if you look at the whole story, it's almost like Jesus snuck in. I mean, it's such a quiet and humble beginning, and a humble life, to such a crescendo of violence and passion with the crucifixion and the amazement of the resurrection. I guess it goes back to God's timing here. I'm just trying to figure out why Jesus didn't come in with trumpets and angels to everybody.
There are such contrasts going on this evening. You know, one contrast we could invest some time in, but I'll just allude to it and we'll go on, is a contrast between two kings. Herod the Great, who has a god complex, who builds monuments to himself, who rules with might, and Jesus, Yeshua, who builds no monuments to himself at all, and yet builds people up as part of his legacy and rules with right. And we could go on and on and on with that comparison. But Christmas is a contrast in kings. That's why that monument to the Herodian that Herod built to himself, which is 3 miles outside of Bethlehem, just stands as a contrast in two kings. Another contrast here is in two leadership styles. Bethlehem is only 5 miles south of Jerusalem, where Temple Mount is. And the leadership of the temple, those Sadducean families, are absolutely and literally corrupt. They're running Temple Incorporated, the biggest cash cow machine of its era and time. They're ripping off people with up to 8 businesses that they're running out of this temple. The two prime rip-off businesses are money changing and animal selling. And instead of shepherding the people as they are called to in God's word, they are exploiting the people. And so this past Advent season, it's been a whole new insight to me. Those shepherds, I think, are there for yet another reason. They are going to represent the consummate leadership style in God's kingdom. Jesus talks about he's the great shepherd. He talks about good shepherds and bad shepherds. And when you get into what it took to be a shepherd in the first century, and I'm just starting to research this, it's a 24/7 calling to comprehensive care of these sheep. These sheep are about the dumbest animals on the face of the earth, and they need constant watch and constant attention, and they have creative ways of just getting into trouble. And so if you're a shepherd, you really are called to a profession that demands everything of you 24/7 to care and nurture and keep these sheep out of trouble. And I think that's one of the reasons that they are there, is that to add to this contrast backdrop of two very different leadership styles going on in this land.
So the way in which Jesus came is really compatible with the essence of God, with his personality, with his leadership style. And that's why it happened this way. Not so much that it was to protect Jesus maybe from being noticed at first.
I think very strong motif messages of the kingdom of God are permeating this evening as well. And let's pick up another one. The angels come to these shepherds and tell them about the good news. Today in the city of David has been born for you. Now, isn't that fascinating? Born for you, a Savior, who will be Christ the Lord, and this will be a sign for you. You will find a baby wrapped in clothes and lying in a manger. I would suggest the key word here is manger. These shepherds are on the outside. They're at the lowest rung of the social ladder. They know there are all kinds of places where they are not welcome. If the angels had come to these shepherds and say, we want you to go to the elite home in Jerusalem, they would have never have done it, because they know they don't belong there. They know the door would get slammed in their face. But when they hear the word manger, a manger is a feeding trough. In the north, it's made out of a black volcanic rock material called basalt, which you can hewn out. But in the south, typically mangers are feeding troughs, maybe 4 foot long, maybe 18 inches wide. And they have sort of a U-shape contour. And that's where the animal feed is placed. And in the south, they're often made from straw and clay and sometimes animal dung. And so this is where the Prince of Peace is laid. As soon as he was born, he was laid in a manger. This is another insight for me from this particular Advent season. Mangers are intended to feed animals. And by way of analogy, the bread of life is laid in a manger for people to come and feed upon him. And so this whole notion of the manger raises an issue for all of us. What are we feeding on these days? Are we feeding on everything else but the Prince of Peace? He is the bread of life. Let's feed on an ongoing basis with him. Let's just freeze that thought. So when this word manger, which is a very, very humble, probably the most humblest of images that could have been given to these shepherds, that's the key word they need to hear to say, oh, these are really poor people if they're laying their baby in a manger. That makes them our kind of people. And so if we go and see them, probably they're not going to slam the door in our face, because they're our kind of folk. They'll probably let us in.
I'm just savoring the image there. I mean, that's just a key point. And it jumps out at me now. Humility. Quiet.
Unpretentiousness.
Yes. That's a key word, too. It's real. Real people. And a real event that went on to shake the world. And if you look at what this baby Jesus grew to become, and the effect, I mean, who remembers Herod anymore in moving his mountain?
You know? Well, I know. And let me pick up what to me is the most glorious theme of this whole Advent season here, and particularly this birth night. As we talked about last week, the clan of David looked upon this couple who arrived, who hadn't had a wedding feast, and they had not been invited to a wedding feast, and immediately their conclusion is sexual promiscuity and adultery, and suddenly there's a projected shame motif onto this couple. And that's why the Catalumas are off limits to them, and why they end up in this small animal holding pen, half cave basement. Well, who are these shepherds? Utterly shameful people in the eyes of this culture. How did Jesus die? The most shameful death possible in this culture, on a Roman cross. Well, what did he do for his ministry? Often he lifted people up out of shame and restored them to fellowship and as citizens in this new inbreaking kingdom of God. This motif of shame starts on the birth night of Jesus and goes all the way through his ministry till the day he dies. This night is glorious from heaven's perspective, but not from the perspective of the clan of David. And if there's one thing I know about every person that walks on the face of this earth, if I had a perfect history knowledge of their life, like I do mine, they are very familiar with shame, as am I. And Jesus came and he identified immediately with people who were living in shame, and he honored them and he lifted them up with the angelic presence and with the first to be able to come and visit and see the Prince of Peace, Emmanuel, God with us, who came that evening.
Doug, it's an astounding story, and to hear it laid out like this is a treat and a blessing, and I thank you for that. And hopefully we've got some more to come next week.
Well, we're pretty much through there, but I think we can come up with some either follow-ons, or maybe we can start to ponder New Year's resolutions and reflect on some issues concerning discipling. It'd be up to you.
I think that would be terrific. We'll talk about that in the interim. And again, thank you for this Advent series. David, I always want to turn over the last question to you, because you just sit there patiently and you listen.
Strangely enough, and the only... Whenever I think of the word manger, I think of the derivations or the other words that have developed in English language. And, you know, one of them is a disease of dog skin, mange. And, you know, to be referred to as mangy, you know, it's negative and nasty and smelly, and, you know, it's a painful, itching condition. I don't know if they're the same derivation, but I've always had that same unsettling feeling in the back of my head that you know, I shouldn't be thinking those nasty, evil thoughts. And today, Doug tells me that was intentional, that he was laid in a manger to be as common as possible, to be as connecting as possible to those of us and to the people of the world who were not born with a silver spoon in their mouth, who don't drive BMWs to work and don't have life, you know, at its highest, at its best.
And I don't know that there's a connection between the words, but the imagery I can see and ties in this humble status, mm-hmm. and lowly beginnings. And service to the humble. And humble almost becomes honest to me, because, Doug, I see humility as being genuine.
Here, well, let me finish off with that theme and close this out. Down in verse 17 in Luke's second chapter, when the shepherds had seen this, they made known the statement which had been told them about this child. Now, if you're a shepherd, with the contextual backdrop that we've provided, who are you going to share this with?
Other shepherds.
There's a lot of people you can't share.
Other humble people.
Mm-hmm. Only other shameful people. Mm. And so the irony of the birth of Jesus is that night is the really good news was first shared from one shameful shepherd to another shameful person, and that's how the gospel first began to be propagated. Mm-hmm. And so let's, you know, when we put this whole thing in perspective here, this is a frenetic time of year. This is when we run to the mall many times with our credit cards. But let's not run to the mall so many times with our credit cards that we don't take time out to bring our hearts to the manger this season.
Excellent advice and a good thought to leave us with. Doug, it's been wonderful. Thank you so much for today and for the series. And we'll look forward to going in some new directions next week.